Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for September the 16th, 2018. Welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we take a look at the City Hall, the State House, and go all the way to the White House. Time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Although a little bit of a hazy start, guys, humidity out there is really something.
Yep. Looking now at 90%, so
it's going down
a little bit. Yeah, 3 percentage points. But still very high, and the cooler temperatures here, of course, close to the lake, you get all that convergence of moisture. You're going to have some fog.
Well, but it's bright and sunny out over the lake, so that's kind of
and sunny
that
now,
off.
And sunny at O'Hare. Another great couple of days here. This weather's been just great.
Hasn't it, though?
Yeah.
I mean, but you can tell fall's coming because it's getting darker earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed
mm-hmm.
that. And just kind of that afternoon sun, the way it kind of... it's kind of a different
it's at a different angle because mm-hmm. it's going down quicker and things are moving around, so it is going to change. And not only is it getting darker earlier, it's getting lighter later.
Yes. When is the time change?
I think it's in November now.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. It was in October and then they moved it up a little bit, so I think it's the first weekend in November. I can check this here as we speak with this new, through the miracle of the internet.
That newfangled thing
called
the internet.
Newfangled thing called the web. Yeah.
Well, yeah, our weather's been beautiful, but boy, I'm thinking of the folks out in the Carolinas with now it's tropical depression, Florence, I guess is what it is. But just the amount of rain that's still to come. It's moving inland at 8 miles an hour, and you look at some of these estimates of additional 10 to 15 inches of rain today in some areas. Accumulations of up to 40 inches are expected in southeast North Carolina and up to 20 inches in western North Carolina. I mean, can you imagine that amount of rain?
No.
I can't fathom that amount of rain. It's just... You know, we see tornadoes all the time and damage and stuff here in the Midwest, but there is nothing like a hurricane and the hurricane damage that it can cause. It's just so vast, the widespread damage that's caused. It's really unbelievable.
Well, there are areas of New Orleans that they say will never totally recover from Katrina. And that's been over 10 years now.
Yeah, I believe it. When George W. Bush was president, I had pool duty for a trip to Florida from Hurricane Charley, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And you just would see these vast areas of destruction. And then you have, on top of that, you've got rain, you've got heat and humidity. And then you have these relief workers trying to do their best to, you know, provide water and goods and services to people, and it's just it just takes your breath away. It really does.
Yep.
But so our thoughts are with all those people out in Carolina, in the Carolinas. What's going on with the football these days? So we had the Bears game that I mm-hmm. tweeted out. I said they played the second half like I thought they would play the first half.
Mm-hmm.
But these teams going out to, what, Northwestern yesterday?
Yep, losing to Akron.
The Illini. Mm-hmm. They go out to, they look great till halftime.
Yep, Soldier Field, they were there too, and they lost to South Florida.
And I didn't even know about the game being at Soldier Field.
It wasn't very well publicized, was it?
No, I was just amazed because I frankly probably would have gone over there yesterday afternoon.
And I'm sure it was kind of weird for Lovie Smith to walk back in there as the head coach of the Illini.
That's true.
But that's what kind of makes that interesting.
Absolutely.
Too. That's a great story in itself. And truly, I did not know until yesterday afternoon, after the game had started, that they were playing at Soldier Field.
Yeah, the only reason I remembered that, I mean, I knew that I had heard it, but the only reason I remembered is I saw several Instagram posts from friends of mine that were actually at the game.
Yeah. I'm really kind of disappointed in the University of Illinois for not doing a better job of publicizing the game. I don't know what they drew yesterday.
It wasn't great. I know there was a lot of empty seats on the west side of the stadium.
Because it was a beautiful day to go watch football.
Yeah, it was gorgeous.
I mean, but is it at halftime that the teams let up, or is it just the ability of the other team to be able to, you know, just outcoach?
Well, I mean, I think the old saying is if you let a team that you're supposed to beat hang around, they might end up beating you. You got to kind of put the pedal to the metal, so to speak, before halftime, and make them worried about the second half instead of, you know, the only thing that undid Northwestern was turnovers. I mean, if you turn the ball over, you're pretty much guaranteeing yourself you're not going to win.
Right.
Unless you have a really talented offense that can score in seconds, which, you know, the Cats do, but, Clayton Thorson had a career high in yardage yesterday, but three turnovers in the second half all leading to points. So that kind of puts a damper on
things. Yeah, it sure does.
You know, and a lot of these teams are also playing, their Super Bowl. I mean, they're getting a chance to play teams that, they watch on TV and don't get as much notoriety as their programs do, and they want to make the most of it.
Sure. Get the big conference attention. Mm-hmm. And
they get money for it, too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But the Bears just stunned me. I mean,
yeah, that was ugly. That was a second half adjustment, or a lack thereof, by Matt Nagy, and also, unfortunately, and I hate to say it, by Vic Fangio as well, because I think he's a very good defensive coach. Been around a long time. Matt Nagy, of course, was coaching in his first NFL game as a head coach, and the game plan was great at the beginning because the first 15 plays were scripted. They that's what they've been practicing.
I agree with you that they just got outcoached.
Well, they got very conservative. They played the game very conservatively from halftime forward, and you can't do that even with Aaron Rodgers on one leg.
The only thing that they weren't conservative was that on a lot of third down short yardage plays.
I thought John Shoup was back calling plays.
They were passes.
Well, not only were they passes, Rick, they were passes. If you needed third and five, they were going 3 yards out.
Right.
You got to go past the sticks.
Yeah. Those third down calls just frustrated the heck out of me. But
plus, they didn't run the clock at that point.
Right.
You're in a complete pass, and it was not fun to watch that second half at all. As fun as the first half was to see the Bears just pasting the Packers at Lambeau.
Yes.
You kind of had that sense. It was, and they kept talking about it on the TV broadcast. Oh, here comes Willis Reed. Oh, stop it already. Stop yourself.
I actually kind of had the sound down for most of the game. But we'll see what happens tomorrow night against the Seahawks.
Seattle Seahawks, yes.
At the home opener.
Correct.
Getting a little concerned about the Blackhawks. I know training camp started.
Mm-hmm.
Corey Crawford.
Yeah, still not ready to go.
And, I mean, we all kind of knew it was a concussion. But, that... that's concerning.
Yeah. You know, there was a play, and I remember seeing it now, as soon as I heard the official statement that it was a concussion. The second to last game that he played, he took one right off the mask, made the save, and then finished the game, and it was one of his better games of the year, and just didn't look right in the next game, and that's the last game he played. So it makes sense. I mean, it does add up to the concussion symptoms, and you know, some people's symptoms don't go away for a long, long time.
I mean, right.
It lingers. I mean, you get not just the headaches, but you lose taste. You lose some of just your sense of smell. And it's just hard to be upright, let alone, playing hockey at a high level.
Sure. And vision issues.
Issues is right. And, it's unfortunate because I think they realized how much they needed him. Well, obviously, from December on to the end of the year last year. Cam Ward is going to be counted on a little bit, it sounds like, here at the beginning of the season, which is probably why they went out and got him as an experienced backup. But Crawford's working out on the ice, which is good. I mean, because last year he would work out, and then they'd shut him down.
Right, exactly.
So at least he's working out now. He had a chance to talk to the media. you had a chance to kind of get clear the air, so to speak, as to what was actually afflicting him last year. And it does make perfect sense. And that's not something you monkey around with.
Well, obviously, we want a healthy Corey Crawford and don't want to rush anything.
Correct.
That's the main thing. So, we got the season opener coming up on the 7th of October.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just right around the corner.
Exactly. As we watch the Cubs, John Lester, great game yesterday.
And remember all the people that were worried about John Lester after that streak of four or five real bad ones?
I was one of them.
Yeah, he's 4-1 with a 1.73 over his last six. 16 wins, season high 9 strikeouts. He's the kind of pitcher that you want, especially when your bullpen is ailing, because he has that bulldog mentality, realizing what the rest of the team is going through, and he perseveres. Some way, somehow, he will get you 7 innings, and that's what he got you yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, a great performance. But, again, concerning, it's the Cincinnati Reds.
Yeah, it's true.
And it's a 1-0 win.
Yeah, you know, the part of the problem with yesterday's game was it started at 3:05. And I know that says people are scratching their head. Why would that make a difference if it started at 3:05? Because the shadows are different at 3:05 than they are at 1:20. And even at noon, if you started the game at noon, or if you start the game at 7, you know, everything's
right.
Shadow-free by then. So it's a little difficult to hit in those conditions, not making excuses, but neither team could hit. So it wasn't just the Cubs yesterday. The Reds have some guys that can hit the ball out of the ballpark. So good pitching in the shadows certainly helped the Cubs yesterday.
Wow, that's a 2.5-game lead. It looks like the Cardinals probably tossed themselves out of the wild card race.
Yeah, it's too bad, isn't it?
Yeah, I was really feeling bad.
I feel awful about that. I'm thinking about sending a sympathy card.
It was like 14-3.
I feel your sincerity here.
Oh, you can tell. Yeah. Would you,
yeah,
can
14 I, to 5.
14 to 5?
Yeah.
I don't want to short him any runs there or anything. But, if you go get the card, I'll be happy
to
sign.
Yeah, cool. I'll get the address and everything. I think you don't even need to just
put Bush Stadium on it.
Yeah, I'll pay for the stamp, too.
Okay. All right. I don't think you need an address. It'll get there.
I have a quick update on the time change this coming.
Yes.
It is Sunday, November 4th.
November 4th.
November 4th.
The Sunday before Election Day.
Yeah, that's right. Sunday, November 4th.
Wow.
Fall back. Fall back day.
One more thing to stress me out now is that. But we get an extra hour. Yeah, we get an extra hour of sleep that day. So
that's right.
That'll be helpful. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news and the time changes. Andy's got the latest sports. Producer Cassara's fielding your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. Our text line is the same number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is keeping an eye on the baseball standings. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Riverside Police Chief Tom Weitzel. He's the police chief of Riverside, and he's concerned about efforts to decriminalize marijuana, possible effects on impaired driving, and we'll talk to him about that. After the 8 o'clock news, we'll speak to Sarah Hamilton. She's a managing partner at the strategic communications firm Kivett. Previously, she was the communications director for Mayor Rahm Emanuel, and we'll talk to her about the mayor's decision not to seek a third term and also what she thinks the city needs in its next mayor. We got a final check of the news and sports at 8:30, and then we'll speak to Jim Durkin. Jim's the Illinois House Republican leader, and we'll talk about the GOP House campaigns as Republicans try to win seats against Democratic incumbents in this critical election season. That's all up ahead, but right now we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Quite a week in national politics. Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman for President Donald Trump, a confidant of the president, pleaded guilty Friday to conspiring against the United States for undisclosed foreign lobbying work. But perhaps more interestingly, he's agreed to cooperate with special counsel Robert Mueller on other crimes that are suspected. And so this only deepens the Mueller inquiry. It says the plea deal says specifically that Manafort is required to cooperate fully, truthfully, completely, and forthrightly with the government. He's also forfeiting properties and assets worth about $22 million. And he does face 10 years in prison. So a very kind of interesting dynamic at work here as we see what happened. We were talking about Hurricane Florence, obviously, and the damage that it has caused. And last week before Florence reached land, President Trump was asked about whether any lessons were learned in the controversial handling of relief efforts last year in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. Instead, Trump offered praise.
I think Puerto Rico was incredibly successful. Puerto Rico was actually our toughest one of all because it's an island, so you can't truck things onto it. Everything's by boat. We moved a hospital into Puerto Rico, a tremendous military hospital in the form of a ship. You know that. And I actually think, and the governor's been very nice, and if you ask the governor, he'll tell you what a great job. I think probably the hardest one we had by far was Puerto Rico because of the island nature. And I actually think it was one of the best jobs that's ever been done with respect to what this is all about.
Then, of course, that was followed by the president on Thursday tweeting out a denial that 3,000 people had been killed in Puerto Rico from Maria. And instead, he blamed Democrats for inflating the figures to make him look bad. And that prompted the governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rossello, to go on CBS News to denounce Trump's tweet. Now, the audio is just a little bit difficult. I want to warn you because the interview was done via Skype.
Neither the people of Puerto Rico nor the victims deserve their pain to be questioned. You know, we went through a rigorous scientific process. We externalized the investigation so that it was an independent investigation. I, you know, in a previous lifetime, I was a scientist, so I evaluated all that went through. And we are very confident that under the current, situations here in Puerto Rico, the value of the investigation was very good. It was very robust. And therefore, that's why I decided to take the initiative to establish as the official death toll number the
2,975. That's the governor of Puerto Rico. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Last Sunday, George Papadopoulos, the one-time Chicagoan who was investigated by special counsel Robert Mueller, Papadopoulos was on ABC's This Week about his plea. George Stephanopoulos asked him about how his proposal that then-candidate Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin was received by the assembled Trump audience.
Candidate Trump at the time nodded at me. I don't think he was committed either way. He was open to the idea, and he deferred, of course, to then senior Senator Jeff Sessions, who I remember being quite enthusiastic about hosting.
You say he was quite enthusiastic. The Attorney General has testified under oath something quite the contrary. I want to show that.
I believe that I wanted to make clear to him that he was not authorized to represent the campaign with the Russian government or any other foreign government for that matter.
There are reports that you shut George down, unquote, when he proposed that meeting with Putin. Is this correct, yes or no?
Yes. I pushed back. I'll just say it that way because it was...
Your answer is yes.
Attorney General says he pushed back. Is he telling the truth?
All I can say is this is a meeting from about 2 years ago. My recollection differs from Jeff Sessions.
So there you have that. That's still developing. And occupying the president's mind on Twitter this week, besides Puerto Rico, was the video tweet he issued marking the two-year anniversary of Hillary Clinton's deplorable speech. So I'm going to play this tweet along with some of the musical soundtrack that went by the hashtag Proud Deplorables.
You could put half of Trump supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it.
Clinton made the comment at a fundraising event here in New York City last night. About 1,000 people attended, and she raised $6 million. She was talking about Trump supporters.
And now we're all proud deplorables. We're proud deplorables. Very proud. Your voice will never, ever be ignored again. They're all going to be coming after you for every election from now on in this country. You will never be ignored again. I took this job on behalf of the forgotten men and women of our country. But guess what? They are forgotten no more. Your dreams are my dreams. Your hopes are my hopes. And your future is what I'm fighting for each and every day.
That was from the President's of the United States Twitter account. Well, joining me now on the phone is the Police Chief of Riverside, Tom Weitzel. Chief, how are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great, thanks.
Thank you so much for joining me this morning. The chief reached out to me and wanted to talk about a very important subject. And in the interest of full disclosure, I've had an issue with this previously myself, the issue of driving under the influence. But this is, it is so serious. And now with talk of expanded medical marijuana program in Illinois, as well as talk about, you know, decriminalizing or even legalizing recreational use of marijuana, I know that you have some very, very strong concerns as it relates to driving.
I do. So what I'm really concentrating on is the drugs you're driving in Illinois and the consequences of that, and really it's become a huge political issue. I think that you know and your listeners would know from polls that have been released that what they're calling recreational marijuana, which is really just a fancy term for legalized cannabis, is the train left the station and it's going down that track, and it's all based on funding. But there's no provisions being contemplated by our state legislators for drug driving prevention and funding for law enforcement. And what I mean by that, Rick, is that if you look at the states that already have medical marijuana and just recreational marijuana legalized, which is basically Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, District of Columbia, they, in 2013, went to legalized cannabis. And their drug driving arrests and fatalities have risen 66%. And those states have no funding for law enforcement to combat that. So what I'm asking our legislators, if this train is going down that track, what's this large amount of money that's going to be coming into the state, we need to put some away for law enforcement for detection, prevention. We need to hire more drug recognition experts, because there's no way for law enforcement to combat drug driving without what they call DRE officers in Illinois. You can't do that. There is not a breathalyzer machine for drugs. We have to have specially trained officers that are able to prosecute these cases and bring these cases to court who have this extensive training. It's very expensive. The equipment is expensive, and there's no funding currently being put in any proposal in Springfield for law enforcement.
Well, I mean, explain, I mean, how does that kind of a drug driving arrest, how does that work? I mean, what is needed?
Very complicated, and that's why a lot of officers really don't like it. I'm telling you the truth, is it's complicated, it's long, and it could take you your entire 8-hour shift, because what happens if you have a drugs driving arrest or you have a crash where one of the drivers is under the influence of cannabis or any other illegal narcotic or even prescription drugs, you have to bring a defendant currently to a hospital and get blood and urine. But of course they can refuse that unless there's a accident where there's great bodily harm to somebody or somebody is there's a fatality involved in that crash. You have to send that to the state police, and then you have to bring that defendant back to your police lockup, and you must conduct what's called DRE testing, which is a series of complicated testing from everything from your pupils, how your pupils are, to your reactions, to something as simple as one of the main things officers do is they look inside your mouth. Because if you've been smoking cannabis, your tongue is green. And a lot of defendants try to eat the cannabis when the officer comes up to their car. Because, Rick, I can tell you that even in my agency, a small agency in Riverside, you know, a population of 9,000, we make traffic stops where the individuals already think it's legal, and they think it's legal to smoke cannabis while they're driving. They don't even put out the cannabis cigarette while the officer's talking to them at the window. So the officer comes up and engages them in the traffic stop and asks for their driver's license. And they're still smoking the marijuana cigarette right in front of the officer because they believe it's already legal.
Well, doesn't that make the arrest easier, though, in that circumstance?
It does. And it wouldn't even be legal, even if cannabis becomes legal. And I got to tell you, this word of recreational cannabis is an actual, it's a purposeful act by the cannabis industry and the proponents for legalized cannabis to make it a friendly word. I mean, I've been to these hearings. They're trying to make it seem like, you know, this recreational cannabis is something that you're going to go to the park with your five-year-old and you're going to have them and put it on the swing set, and you can sit next and smoke marijuana while you have your child in the park on the swing. Well, it's much more complicated than that. There's no funding at all, and I'm at a minimum asking for funding for especially DRE officers. There's only about 115 drug recognition experts in Illinois, in the whole state. And it's because it's very expensive. You have to send your officers away for this training, and the equipment to go with it is very expensive. And one other thing I asked my state legislators for is funding for a roadside device that can test for the cannabis or illegal narcotics, because we do have portable breath testers that officers can bring in their squad car. You blow right on the street, and it'll tell you whether you've been drinking and what the blood alcohol concentration is. No such device exists right now for that type of enforcement. Now, there is some prototypes out there. One is made by a company in California, and actually there's one made by a company in Germany. And there is a police department here in Illinois. So the Carroll Stream Police Department is helping test a device, but those devices are not certified for court testimony yet. So we need to put funding to these, or it could be as simple, Rick, as an officer responding to a very serious injury crash, and it's a fatality or it's great bodily harm, and we don't have the tools to hold somebody accountable, even in a fatality.
We're speaking with Riverside Police Chief Tom Weitzel. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. (312) 981-7200 is our phone number. This is your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. I'm speaking with Tom Weitzel. He's the police chief of Riverside. We're talking about drug driving enforcement as we see the state looking at relaxing the criminalization of marijuana. And, Chief, I know you were talking about funding for law enforcement training, funding for, you know, helping research for devices to enforce the laws. But are the laws themselves adequate to deal with an expansive use of marijuana?
Well, I think that they've made it complicated. So, you know, when they did the medical marijuana, the governor's office had an initiative to kind of reclassify what it takes to be prosecuted for a drug driving arrest, and specifically in the cannabis field, you have to have a certain amount of milligrams. It gets to be very complicated. So to keep it simple, the objective to law enforcement was, you know, so you, when we have medical marijuana, you could go to a legalized medical marijuana store, purchase your cannabis, go outside in the parking lot, smoke up, get in the car and drive home, and you should be able to make a DUI drug arrest if that happens. The old law said yes, you could, because any amount of an illegal compound in the system for drugs was a DUI. That changed, where you have to have a certain amount of milligrams in your blood system, so officers have to bring defendants to the hospital and do blood and urine in every case. So the laws, if recreational, so-called recreational marijuana comes to be passed here in Illinois, there are, in my opinion, we need to tweak the laws so that motorists who are either under the influence of cannabis and other drugs can be held accountable, especially for crashes involving injuries and harm to individuals. We don't have the proper legislation, in my opinion. It's there. It just needs to be tweaked.
The basics are there, but it needs to be updated to whatever happens. I mean, is there any doubt in your mind that we're probably going to be legalizing marijuana?
No, I would be less than honest with you. I'm not a proponent of legalized cannabis, but I attended a hearing in Chicago where the state legislators at a committee brought in the revenue director from Colorado, and I watched her testify for over 2 hours, and she told our state legislators how they brought in $750 million. And I think our state legislators' eyes popped out when they were hearing this. And then when law enforcement came up to testify, they wouldn't allow us to testify. And because all I wanted to say is, can you put that $750 million that Colorado is bringing in, if that happens here in Illinois, can we put 1% of that into funding for law enforcement? Not for anything, just for drug driving. And they wouldn't even entertain that. But when that revenue director testified as to what they're bringing in, just in Colorado, not the other states, I could see that our state legislators were very, very, very interested in putting this on the fast track.
I know, obviously, you're concerned about the effects on driving, but overall, if marijuana were to be decriminalized, wouldn't that also maybe free up law enforcement in a lot of cases?
You know, that's false. If you talk to Colorado, for example, out there they have what's called HIDA, the high intensity drug trafficking area. We have a HIDA unit in Illinois also, but they compile information for both the state legislature in Colorado and the public, and crime has gone up 32% in Colorado since this goes back to 2013, since either legalized cannabis has gone into effect. So how did they link that to cannabis? Well, some of it was that these legally selling cannabis shops and the cultivation centers, they're dealing in cash. They did a study of how much crime occurred like within a 6-block area of a legalized cannabis distribution site and a cultivation site. And there's robberies. There's robberies of the stores. There's robberies of people that come out of the stores. There was more crime increased in that area. So police had to, put resources towards that. And many, as you might know, the federal government, they weren't allowing you to use credit cards.
Right.
So everyone's dealing in cash. So it's really a dangerous situation. In fact, a lot of the law enforcement agencies and the legalized cannabis states, the manufacturers of that want to hire off-duty police officers to be security guards at their stores because they were wanting to eliminate or reduce crime. Well, many police chiefs will not allow their officers to work at these cannabis distribution sites as security officers because they just don't want their officers working where they're selling cannabis. But those cannabis distributors and those manufacturers and those cultivators have actually reached out to the chiefs in those areas and said, listen, can we hire your police officers off duty just to stand guard at our facilities?
So you say you want some money for enforcement, you want some money for training, but you said that this committee, the legislators at this committee didn't even listen to anybody from law enforcement.
No, it was actually deplorable, Rick. So I was there in person along with some other chief representatives from the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police, and actually DEA was there, Chicago was there, and they flew in the revenue director from Colorado, and she probably testified for a good 2 hours about their program. And then we had our written testimony, meaning law enforcement, and we were waiting our turn to sit in front of this subcommittee and testify, and they shut the hearing down. And it was so controversial that I had my written testimony. I actually walked up to the state legislators and I asked them to take my written testimony and include it in the record. If they weren't going to let me orally testify, then I wanted my statement put in the record, and they still didn't accept it.
Has the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police taken a formal position?
They have. The Illinois Chiefs of Police and even the Illinois Sheriff's Association are not supporting legalized cannabis.
And as you say, there's even existing concerns right now about the medical marijuana use.
Yes. So there has been cases of the medical marijuana use. It's being expanded for sure. And as Illinois gets legalized cannabis, then the medical marijuana will just fall into one category. But anybody that has a distribution site in their community will tell you that, you know, they've had either arrests or crashes in the area. Now, it's not alarming. It's not to the point where, you know, it's happening every day. That would be over-exaggerating. But it is a concern. And sometimes the people are lining up awful early to purchase their cannabis because it's in all forms. You know, I mean,
right.
You can get cannabis in your brownies, right? So,
right.
And you know what's happening in the high schools, Rick, is that they're vaping it. So they put the cannabis oil into what you would look for a vaping device just for smoking, like regular tobacco. And the kids are using the cannabis oil and they're vaping it in school.
All things to be concerned about as the legislation moves forward in Springfield. Riverside Police Chief Tom Weitzel, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Rick. You have a great morning.
We'll be back with more right after this.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome to your second hour of the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Taking a look at congressional and Senate ads from around the country, and one thing is clear, we're seeing more guns being featured as prop. In West Virginia, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin is trying to hold on to his seat, and he uses a shotgun to tout his reelection effort.
That's me, shooting the cap and trade bill, because it was bad for West Virginia. Hey, I haven't changed. I might be a few years older, but I'll still take on anyone that messes with West Virginia.
Now the threat is Patrick Morrissey's lawsuit to take away health care from people with pre-existing conditions. He is just dead wrong, and that ain't going to happen. I'm Joe Manchin, and I approve this message because for me, it's all about West Virginia.
So you've got that. And then over in Maine, Democrat Jared Golden is challenging Republican Congressman Bruce Poliquin. Well, guess what? Golden's using that in his campaign, too.
Bruce Poliquin is taking pot shots at Jared Golden, but his false attacks are way off target. Jared Golden has always served us first, not special interests. As a Marine in Afghanistan and Iraq, an aide to Susan Collins, and a leader in the Maine House.
I'm Jared Golden, and I approve this message. Because while Bruce Poliquin hides from his votes to gut Social Security and Medicare, I'm a straight shooter.
I guess that's one way to punctuate your campaign message. Well, joining me now on the phone is Sarah Hamilton. Sarah's a managing director of Kivit, a strategic communications firm. She's also the former communications director for Mayor Rahm Emanuel. And I figure if anybody knows about the mayor and his thinking as he decided now not to seek a third term, Sarah would be very good to talk to. Sarah, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. I guess, one, I was very surprised. Were you surprised at his decision?
I was more surprised than not. I'll say that. There's always a chance that an incumbent, in this case the mayor, decides that they don't want to run, but I was surprised and a little sad.
I mean, I kind of got the feeling that, you know, this is a guy who's never shied away from a fight in his years in government and politics, that it was just like, is it worth the fight?
I think it's that, but I really think it's what he said about starting a new chapter of his life. I mean, I think it's a very valid point. It would have been a tough race. I think he would have prevailed, but I think there's also, as he said, you know, he and Amy have put a lot of things on hold over the past, you know, more than 20 years, and they want to do some things while they still have the time, energy, and resources, and now that all their kids are all in college. they have that opportunity and they're going to seize it. So I do take him at his word on that, but, you know, I have no doubt it would have been a tough race, but a winnable one for him.
This is just, I mean, it's an immense job.
Yes. Every day. Every day of the year, every hour, every minute of it.
Give me an example of a day with the mayor.
Well, they start early. I think, you know, most Chicagoans probably know by now, and, you know, every member of the press corps knows he's up early, you know, 4:30, 5 o'clock every day. And so you have to be. And his day starts with, like a lot of us do, reading the news, getting messages overnight, you know, what happened in the handful of hours that he was asleep. And then it's off to the races, you know, like what's on schedule for the day. Usually he's either going to an L stop or a school early in the morning, and then he's in the office doing anything and everything, you know, any problem that comes at you, whether it's something to do with public safety, education, transportation, water, budgets, finance, and then all of the above at the same time. And he's typically has multiple events each day, and then when 6:30, 7 o'clock rolls around, he has an evening event and then heads home and finishes up paperwork and reading the news and then probably has dinner and starts over again. So and that's just on his side. On the staffer side, it just kind of keeps going with all the cleanup work and all the to-dos that he's given throughout the day. But it is a lot, and it doesn't end, and it's kind of a one big roller coaster ride, but it's very fun. And I think it was very obvious when he announced that he was not going to seek a third term that it, you know, it was emotional for him because he does love the job and love the work.
You know, I have to think too that mayors are kind of a unique political job, a governmental job, only because, you know, even as we have this race for governor going on, that mayor of Chicago, you're on the front line.
Mm-hmm.
And
you sure are.
And you have to make hard, direct decisions. I mean, it's kind of like I always joked about, you know, with my years in Springfield, that being a state senator or a state representative from Chicago was relatively easy, because if anybody was focused on politics, they're focusing on who's the alderman and who's the mayor.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, you're on the front lines. I used to tell people all the time, like, we pick up trash, we fill potholes, we make sure that, you know, your kids get to and from school safely. And if you don't do your job, you hear about it. And it's not like in Springfield or in D.C. where eventually it'll trickle down and you might hear something. No, you hear about it that day. You know, someone, I can't tell you how many times I was with the mayor out in any neighborhood of the city, and someone would say, you know, we had this pothole, could you get it fixed? Or thank you for, you know, doing these, you know, the curb bump outs for ADA access. So it's true. All the little things, they are, the mayor is held responsible and the local alderman. And, you know, we're Chicagoans. We're not shy, and people are very boisterous about what's going on in their neighborhood, and they're not afraid to go up to their mayor or their alderman to tell them what they think.
And they want it done now.
Of course.
That's also part of it. We're speaking with Sarah Hamilton, Managing Director of Kivett, former Communications Director for Mayor Rahm Emanuel. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. And joining me on the phone is Sarah Hamilton, Managing Director of Kivett and the former Communications Director for Mayor Rahm Emanuel. We're talking about the mayor's decision as well as this now looming mayoral race. And I guess, Sarah, when you look at having been inside the hall and inside the mayor's office, you look at this huge field. What, in your view, does it take to be the next mayor of Chicago?
Well, I'll say this: it's not a job for anyone who wants to have an easy life or not really be on call every day, every hour of the year. I mean, you need someone who has a wealth of experience dealing with a whole host of issues. You know, I think looking at the field of declared candidates now, we have a lot of people who have deep background on one or maybe two issues. And unfortunately, that doesn't cut it, not in this role, like, because it, being mayor of Chicago, it's not just about one thing. It comes at you from every direction every day. So you have to, if you're an education expert, that's great. But what do you know about transportation, public safety, the budget, water, sewers? I mean, you get what I'm saying. So the list goes on and on. And if you can't, it's not just one thing, it's everything. You know, you have to attract companies to the city. You have to continue to raise Chicago's profile on the global stage. And that requires someone who's pretty dynamic and able to make those calls and have those calls returned. And while also being able to focus on all those kind of nuts and bolts mayoral issues that the city needs.
Well, and with Bill Ruthart, he and I wrote a story last Sunday's paper, and I think we noted that this is not, if you're looking for a prize, this ain't the job.
No. This is it's the best worst job. It's the best job because Chicago is, you know, the greatest city in the world, and what an honor to lead it and kind of pick up where, you know, where Mayor Emanuel will leave off. But it's the worst job in the sense that we're not perfect. We have a lot of issues that need solving and a lot of just regular day-to-day problems that the next mayor will have to focus on, in addition to some real big, you know, generational issues that won't sleep because, you know, the clock says midnight.
Well, when Mayor Emanuel first ran, and it basically said, you know, the city needs somebody to make the hard decisions. And mm-hmm. at that time, I said, the trouble with hard decisions are they're not necessarily politically favorable ones.
That's right.
And, you know, what in the mayor's tenure, I mean, that sets the stage for even harder decisions to come from the person who follows him.
Yeah, that's true. He was 100% correct about hard decisions. You're 100% correct. They're not always very popular, and politically, they're really difficult. So I think the next person is going to, if they shy away from those decisions, I think the voters and the people will call them out on it, because you can't. We have big problems, and the only way to solve them is by confronting them head on, which, as we all know, is the way the mayor operates. And the next mayor cannot sit back and take the easy road. We know what happens when that decision is not made, so to speak.
Well, I mean,
we have to go right at it.
We've made some progress with our fiscal problems, but
yes,
but you can't just stop. And you know, yes, taxes are horrible. Everybody hates taxes. Understood. But you know, to right the ship, that's part of the equation. And
it sure is.
And there's going to be more to come, let's face it. But at the same time, you still have to do things like work on keeping the economic viability of this city going and growing. And
right.
And I mean, it's not just taxes are always the answer kind of thing. It's part of how the equation of how to move the city forward. And we're not at a position, I don't think, that we can sit back and relax at this stage.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And it's a balance because, you know, you're right. Nobody likes taxes, but they are, it's a fact of life. And I think raising them was a very difficult decision, but one that had been put off for too long. On our fiscal situation with respect to the pensions, the mayor's made tremendous progress, but even he would say we're not finished, not even close, but the city's on more stable footing. But, you know, business development is a key aspect to any thriving city, and making sure that companies want to locate here and do their business here. And companies are famous for not liking taxes in any way, shape, or form. So you have to find the balance of how do you attract them without scaring them away of any sort of financial burden or liability that they may face. So the new mayor will have to, you know, continue to find, or not, but hopefully continue to find that balance where they're able to make improvements to the city, not just on our finances, but also on things that we need to spend money on, like our roads and our transportation system, and continue to improve the L and and also making sure that we can pay our bills, but then attract people, and they're not in companies, so they're not too afraid that, oh, there's, you know, there's too much liability there. I don't want to do work there, because I think everyone who lives, works, and loves Chicago will tell you that it's a great place to do business and raise a family.
And there is the Springfield component that whoever the next mayor is going to have to work with whoever the next governor is.
Right.
And we've kind of seen what happens when that doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah, or when Springfield just kind of comes to a stall, and that doesn't work for anyone. And hopefully that whoever the next governor is, we'll get some movement down there, and Illinois can start moving again as well.
Well, especially, you know, when we see how the city is always, when you go 90 miles outside the city, and the city is the boogeyman, the political
right.
boogeyman.
And, right, yes.
And how Chicago always gets more of its fair share, even though we just...
we don't.
talked about the fact that, yeah, that it's actually the downstate that gets more than its fair share of the tax money. But, well, that's not convenient to talk about facts when it comes to being able to bash Chicago downstate.
Exactly. We're an easy target.
Exactly. Sarah Hamilton, Managing Director of Kivett, former Communications Director for Mayor Rahm Emanuel, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
My pleasure. Have a great Sunday.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here on the 18th floor in the Allstate Skyline Studio, overlooking the Chicago River. The haze has gone away. The haze has burned off. It looks like a beautiful day. I've been playing some ads from other campaigns. Also, a kind of an interesting thing going on. Texas always considered a red state, but Republican Senator Ted Cruz there is facing a tough challenge from Democrat Beto O'Rourke. So tough, in fact, that President Trump is headed there to rally for Cruz. Rick Tyler, a former top Cruz aide, told MSNBC that Beto O'Rourke should be taken seriously.
It's possible. I mean, people will say, no, it's not possible, because you look at Texas and you say it's a red state and
it's a Democratic pipe dream. It's never going to happen.
It's never going to happen. But Beto O'Rourke has consistently out fundraised Ted, I think 2-1. He doesn't take PAC money. The race should be a 10 or 15 point race. It's not. It's a 0-4 point race, and Beto O'Rourke is running an interesting campaign, and he's grabbed national attention. So it's a race.
It's a race. We've also talked about the matchup for governor of Florida between Congressman Ron DeSantis, the Republican, and Democratic Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, who he is seeking to become Florida's first black governor. Well, Florida is the Space Coast state, and the Republican Governors Association has an ad using that kind of theme in going after Gillum.
How far out is Andrew Gillum? He's on another planet.
Come in, Planet Andrew. Over.
Andrew Gillum wants a government takeover of healthcare. You'd lose the coverage you have, and you could even lose your doctor.
Planet Andrew, we're losing radio contact.
Gillum wants to increase Florida taxes by $1 billion. Disaster for the economy. And he supports closing our immigration enforcement agency. Dangerous.
Planet Andrew, come in.
You'd better learn more about Andrew Gillum. He just goes too far.
And that's the ad in Florida run by the Republican Governors Association. Well, joining me now here in the Skyline Studio, the Allstate Skyline Studio, is the Republican leader of the Illinois House, Jim Durkin from Western Springs. Leader Durkin, thank you for joining me this
morning. Good morning, Rick. It's great to be here in your new studios. This is quite a view. Breathtaking, and it's very clean up here, too.
I was going to say, you were most impressed by the cleanliness factor, I think.
And the budget has been increased, as I saw you had some Danish outside, front cut up into little squares. So
No, that actually, that was Dave Schwann. So that
okay.
that came out of his pocket.
No, glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you for allowing me to attend your fundraiser last week in Chicago. Reince Priebus, former Republican National Committee chairman, former chief of staff to Donald Trump. An interesting choice of a keynoter. And Priebus has always been kind of had an interest in Illinois and Chicago.
Interesting is how I like to have my events. I've had some interesting keynotes over the last 3 years. Governor Walker from Wisconsin, Governor Kasich from Ohio, and Governor Ricketts from Nebraska. And I think it's important just to have somebody who's fun, somebody who's interesting, somebody who's topical. And Priebus, I have friends of friends, and I thought he'd be interesting to give a perspective on the lay of the land. But, you know, this is a person that he was the 21st chief of staff to the president of the United States, and I just thought it'd be interesting. And it's a fundraiser, too, so, you know, that this is the type of person that will, you know, generate some interest in people who will write checks.
It helps when, like, Bob Woodward has a book out.
At the same day, the timing was uncanny, because the day in which the book was released was the day in which he was in Chicago for my event.
Is there a Trump factor in state legislative races?
Downstate Illinois, there is. I wouldn't say so much in the suburbs. People are focused in, you know, I think people in the area are, they can distinguish between Washington, at least up in the collars, and also in the burbs where I'm at. I think that it's an issue, but people are more focused on what's happening with the governor's race, the legislature. Downstate Illinois, I will say that there is a large Trump factor, and they're very, very protective and very supportive of the president, and that bodes well for our candidates downstate.
How does that manifest itself, that when you say that? I mean, is it's
very strong on immigration. I'm just looking at the trends of the way that Illinois has been over the past 10 years, in which Southern Illinois was always a very strong Democrat area.
Although it was conservative, Democrat.
But those conservative Democrats are voting Republican these days, you know, on gun rights, on issues of choice, taxes. It seems like it's more pronounced down there and leaning strongly on the Republican side. So we've got to be able to thread the needle in the different districts, but right now our issue is the focus is going to be on the state budget and the way in which things have been handled for decades under Mike Madigan, and also Emil Jones, Janet Cullerton, but also, you know, what does J.B. Pritzker do for Illinois, and how is he going to change the status quo? So that is what's getting the attention of people up here for us.
You know, when you look at those suburban areas, and we've obviously seen kind of a evolution in the demographics in politics to some extent. I mean, I do remind people about how the collars in the presidential, all except McHenry, voted for Hillary Clinton in the general election.
Correct.
And to me, that also kind of, as far as suburban voters, I think one of the big keys is, and always has been, basically, is moderate suburban women, socially moderate suburban women. And I think that's going to be an even more important factor this year. I mean, back in, you used to call them soccer moms, you know, I think. But I think, truly, I think they're going to be a more defining group this time.
They are, absolutely. My caucus, when we get into issues that, you know, that are volatile, whether it's Second Amendment rights or it's issues regarding choice, I mean, we don't take caucus positions. We, you know, I talk to my members, and we kind of just kind of feel them out about where they're at on a particular issue, and just kind of think of what this vote could mean this next cycle. So I think we've done a very good job of trying to at least manage our members and having their votes kind of define the area that they live. I mean, this is part of my job, and it is. But you know what? I think that we're positioned well in many of our seats to capture, I think, those soccer mom votes. While a lot of them think about Trump, a lot of them also think about the Speaker of the House. Sure. And that is when we knock on doors, that is a question that is brought up, independent doors, Republican doors, Democrat doors, and the status quo of Springfield. That is almost overwhelming, more so than you hear about in the Washington level.
Just to go back to the diversity level and stuff, and obviously, you know, it's not easy to lead in a diverse state, and governors know that, legislative leaders know that. But are we getting to the point in our politics where diversity, which I always viewed as a great asset, are we to the point in politics where diversity may be a bad thing when it comes to the regionalization in the state?
I don't think so. I mean, you have to adapt and to...
I mean, I never thought we'd get concealed carry, a law, actually, given the vast differences.
Well, I never thought we would either, but the fact is we didn't have a choice based on what the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and the consequences of us not enacting a concealed carry law would have had a dramatic effect upon our gun laws. But, look, this is a process that is ever-changing. You know, it's... and we have to... assess. We have to make adjustments with candidates, their communications, and you know, diversity is good, but it forces us to have to really think hard about what's important for people in the state, in our region, in our districts, and that's ultimately is what we have to do as legislators. But also, this is how we're going to be able to make the case to people of why we should have more members, why we should be reelected. I mean, it's a job that's constantly changing. The attitudes of the suburbs, the collars, and downstate Illinois. Now, we know where downstate Illinois is, but in the suburbs, we know that the attitude changes, and people are. It's a different mindset. It's a different socioeconomic group, and you've got to be able to determine what exactly they're looking for.
We're speaking with Jim Durkin. He is the Illinois House Republican leader from Western Springs. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Skyline studio by Illinois House Republican leader Jim Durkin. Leader, how do you pick up seats?
Well, over the next month and a half, we're going to find out. We've been at this for a while, months, if not the past year, recruiting candidates that reflect the district. We have open seats in different areas of the state. We feel that our advantage is going to be in downstate Illinois, the Metro East area, but we also are competing in the suburbs and a few seats in the collar counties. I feel that we have an advantage. We are polling our districts regularly. We know we're playing defense in some areas, but we believe that we have a better opportunity on the on offense in a number of seats. Well, I think that our message has been very strong. It's been consistent. We think that the status quo that people have been frustrated with is what we're capitalizing on, and this is what helped us pick up four seats that last election, where Hillary Clinton won by 18 votes in Illinois. In a blue
18%.
State. 18%. Yeah, that's right, 18%. A little difference between 18 points and 18%. So we were able to continue on with that, with our message on it, about people, again, they're able to distinguish between Washington and Springfield about what has happened in Illinois over the past many years under, you know, the control of the House of Representatives, the Senate, under the Democrat control. And people get it. They understand it. And they are extremely frustrated with the Democrat leadership of Illinois, more so than any other aspect in state government.
One of the things I've been surprised at, and it's sometimes alluded to by Governor Rauner, but I'm surprised it isn't alluded to more often, and that's the importance of this governor's race in deciding the boundaries of legislative districts following the next census and what that means as far as Democrats having the opportunity, as they did in this under this current map, to draw those districts to favor Democrats, and that the election of a Republican governor would be the backstop to prevent that from happening. I don't know that I hear this, and I know, you know, redistricting it's geeky kind of thing or whatever, but I think it's actually a pretty straightforward message.
It is, but I think that the stronger message is what, and this came out of the mouth of J.B. Pritzker right after the election, that I'm going to raise the current taxes on everybody on the flat rate, and then I'm going to change Illinois into an escalating tax system against all economic classes. And we can get into the weeds about what it means with the redistricting process, and some people get it, but by the time you articulate it and then you explain it, remember, you have an attention span that you have a limited amount of time in which you can explain a complicated process to people. But for us in the know, that is the most important aspect of this governor's race.
Maybe
to be able to draw the districts.
I was going to say, maybe it's being too much in the bubble, as it were.
I think it is. You know, you've got to find out what are the messages that people are going to hang on to. And they're going to hang on to what has happened.
Well, taxes are always going to be.
Taxes, and, you know, you've got one person, Pritzker, who's almost giddy about the fact that he's going to raise taxes. And he wants to change the tax code, but he won't have the courage to say exactly what the rates are. I mean, that's insane. He's just saying that I'm going to raise taxes against him and Bruce Rauner, but it's not the case. There's been a Democrat proposal that's been sitting out there for the past year that's going to tax the middle class at higher rates.
That was never a realistic proposal.
It doesn't. You know what? They put it in. They introduced the bill, and that's the only thing you can reference back to.
I understand that, but also it was never a realistic proposal. It was one basically done to outline here's liabilities and here's receivables.
True, but the fact is the Democrats have never been shy about making mention of legislation that we've introduced over the past years as well. But the fact is that is right there the most important aspect of this race is what is Mr. Pritzker planning to do with the spending, which he wants to spend more, and he has no plan on addressing the pension systems, our business climate. All he wants to do is tax, and I think just wants to legalize marijuana. That's what I hear.
Well, how much of the fate of your members and your candidates is dependent upon the fate of the governor's race, in your estimation?
I think that we're running parallel tracks. Yes, we're working with the governor, as we have been over the past
years. I mean, he's heavily funding your
Absolutely.
Campaign.
No, he is funding because he believes in the House. He believes that what we've done over the past 3 years is important. We've done...
You're the barricade, as he said the other night.
We are. We are. I use this figure all the time, but we've stopped Mike Madigan 142 times in the House of Representatives over the past 3 years. And this is a man who's had plenary control over Springfield for decades and is not used to losing important votes. It's not just important votes, but just, you know, whether, you know, the big, you know, the big marquee ones. But we've done a very good job of stopping things, forcing compromise on major issues in the House of Representatives because Mike Madigan can't get the votes on passing education reform. And we ran into the budget this year, which he knew he had to get a budget done because his members were not going to allow him to leave one that was balanced. And he brought the Republicans. We found out a way, and we negotiated, myself, Senate leader, and the four leaders negotiated a budget.
But go back to the original question. When you say, you know, you're on parallel tracks with the governor, is his success... does the success of your organization and campaign, is that dependent upon him being successful and for re-election?
You know, I would hope so. And I can't make that.
I just mean
the governor's going to have success. He's polling's all over the place right now, and he's at the same place where he was at 4 years ago, as far as I'm concerned. I think the governor is. You know, I think he plays well in the suburbs. I really do. I think that the positions that he has been strong on, his position on business reform, is what people want to hear about, that he's taking on Mike Madigan. And people realize it and they respect that. So I can't say right now whether or not our success is going to be guided by the governor's success, but we're rowing in the same direction. We have different themes that our members have to run on, which the governor doesn't. You know, we have a difference of opinion on some matters, but at the end of the day, we've got a pretty good. Our approach towards these elections has been we go through this on a weekly basis with the governor's staff. We have messages that we are unified on, other messages which members have to do based on their districts, but we're very well coordinated, and I can't make that decision at this moment, but I feel that we're in a good position to pick up seats against Mike Madigan, build on what we did the last cycle, and we're doing good work in the House of Representatives, and I think people are starting to realize that it's good to have somebody that's standing up to Mike Madigan, stopping him, and forcing things to be done in a negotiated manner.
That's Jim Durkin. He is the Illinois House Republican leader. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.